underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. The technological marvel of its age, the Erie Canal, grew out of a sudden fit of inspiration. Proponents didn't just dream, they built a 360-mile waterway entirely by hand and largely through wilderness. An excitement crackled down its length, the canal became the scene of the most striking outburst of imagination in American history. The Erie Canal made New York the financial capital of America and brought the modern world crashing into the frontier. Men and women saw God face to face, gained and lost fortunes, and reveled in a period of intense spiritual creativity. The new book, Heaven's Ditch, by historian Jack Kelly, illuminates the spiritual and political upheavals along this psychic highway from its opening in 1825 through 1844. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jack Kelly to this week's book show. Jack, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, Joe, thanks for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
Very nice to speak with you again. That idea, and I'd just like to begin here, of a psychic highway, that is one thing that surprised me about this story, because I expected to hear very much about this technological marvel and not so much about this the psychic world that inhabited the story.
Well, there's been a number of very good books about the building of the Erie Canal, and I didn't want to revisit that story so much as I wanted to look at the effects of the canal and the religious and spiritual energy that was, and enthusiasm that was generated when the canal opened in 1825.
What brought you to the story of wanting to look at the building of the canal?
Well, you know, I think, Joe, that most writers, I try to write the book I'd like to read, and I've always been interested in the history of technology, so I was interested in the canal, and I've always had an interest in spirituality and religion, so the fact that these two things came together and were related in a lot of different ways, and the fact that I grew up along a canal was sort of a homecoming subject for me, so it was a great pleasure to write the book.
How much did you realize of the spiritual side of this story when you started it?
Well, I actually was quite familiar with the religious and spiritual and political subjects from that era. There was a book written back in the 40s called The Burden Over District, which pulled together this concept of a area of the country that had this great religious upsurgence, and that I'd read that years ago, and I was quite influenced by it.
So as you start to take on the story and look at what happened along the way, of course, you bring us to the beginning of why this project was started. So give us a little bit of the baseline as to why we have an Erie Canal.
Well, the water transport in those days, the early decades of the 19th century, everything moved by water. Roads were terrible in America. And there was the Hudson River was a great avenue of water that reached 150 miles inland. And the Great Lakes were obviously another area had easy transport of along the Great Lakes. But there was no connection. So the idea of connecting the Hudson River to Lake Erie, and from Lake Erie you could travel by boat all the way up to Chicago, all the way out to Chicago. Finally, you know, it had been floating around for quite a while, and finally in the early decades of the 1800s, it sort of came together. A man named Jesse Hawley actually wrote a series of essays that proposed the canal, and had a great deal of foresight because his the route that he planned for the canal and even the cost of the canal were very accurate as to what happened about 20 years later.
And as you write in the book, it initially, and even when you think of it today, it seemed impossible.
The longest canal in the country at that time was about 27 miles, and that had taken 9 years to build. And that was, as all canals were, there were quite a few canals at the time in England, but all canals were built in settled areas and built-up areas. So the idea of building a canal through a wilderness was, many people just thought it was preposterous, just, you know, it was an impossibility.
And there were no engineering schools. There weren't people to draw from. So where did those people come from that had the skill to do this?
I have a theory that people that went out to the frontier and had to confront nature in its raw form developed a kind of self-reliance, adaptability, and so they picked men. Most of the engineers were from at that time was the frontier up around Rome and Utica, and many of them had worked as magistrates, so they had spent time surveying for lot lines, and they had to take that skill and from there learn all the other skills involved in, and you know, frankly, they got encyclopedias, English encyclopedias, and read articles about canals, and that's how they learned.
In the beginning, and of course, as you write, there are many challenges, but just to be able to start the project and to go forward, I assume they had a will to want to do it. And was there a timeline? Was there someone over them saying this has to be done by this time?
Well, it was a quite a miracle almost that it was completed in 8 years, because if you extrapolate from the one canal that had been built in the country, it would have taken over 100 years to build the same 360-mile canal. And it was also, it was a very delicate political process to get the funding to get the canal first approved in the state of New York. They tried for federal funding unsuccessfully. Then they had to raise the money. And it was like many projects, many big public works projects, it was a matter of pulling all these things together and having it happen. And DeWitt Clinton, who was the great champion of the canal, that was one of his big achievements, was not the technical aspect, but pulling everything together and getting the project underway.
The subtitle of the book, God, Gold, and Murder. So let us go in that order if we can.
Okay.
Beginning with God, and of course bringing us to Western New York and the story that unfolds in the 1820s.
The people that went out to the frontier and went out along a canal were mostly young people, and they had, almost all of them were either from eastern part of New York State or from New England, and they'd grown up in the Puritan tradition in New England. Most of them, as many people were, the majority of people were in those days, were very religious. But once they got out there, they broke away from those Orthodox traditions and either came up with new forms of Christian beliefs or invented their own religions altogether. And it was the frontier had that quality of infecting people, I think, with just new ideas. And, you know, it's hard for us to imagine, but, you know, to go into the frontier, there was a woman named Jemima Wilkinson who had gotten a kind of a cult in New England. And she could have lived a very comfortable life in New England, but she decided to go out to the frontier, and that was in Western New York. She was one of the first groups of white people to settle in Western New York. And something about that attracted her to have an isolated community and to confront nature and to build your houses and everything they had, they built themselves. The Shakers were very similar. So there was, I think, that interaction with the frontier was a big part of the religious enthusiasm and excitement that evolved along the canal.
Jack Kelly is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book is Heaven's Ditch, God, Gold, and Murder on the Erie Canal. You mentioned living just off the canal in a town outside of Rochester and hearing stories, you say, of finding gold. And that was something that captivated you.
Well, I had gotten into the idea of the money dig, what they called the money diggers. It actually started in the 18th century and was prevalent throughout the Northeast well into the 19th century. And I came across a story in relation to Joseph Smith, who led some of these money digging expeditions. But there were many others. For example, Fort Stanwix in Rome. They now have a model, if you've ever been to Rome, of Fort Stanwix right in the middle of town. The original Fort Stanwix was totally demolished and dug to pieces by money diggers. And these were people who had the idea that somehow pirate treasure, even though they lived way inland from the ocean, pirates had come up there and buried treasure. Sometimes they said it was Revolutionary War pay chests that had been buried and forgotten, but somehow there was this treasure under the earth, and it was a strange phenomenon. I think a lot of it was done pretty much for fun. They go out at night and drink and dig here and there, and I compare it now to the lottery. It's like you could say, well, you know, you play the lottery, you don't have much of a chance of winning, but it's fun to play it and imagine things. And that was, you know, to them, I think it was a lot of similar motivation for it, was to just for the fun of it.
And then there was the murder.
Yeah, the crime of the century that I discuss in the book, and it really was a crime of the century, was a man named William Morgan, who was writing a book about the Freemasons, and he had been a Freemason. He got disillusioned with them and was going to reveal their secrets, and he thought this would, like every author, I guess, he thought it was going to be a bestseller. And he was warned not to write it. He'd sworn an oath that he would never reveal these secrets, and when it came close to his pub date of his book, he disappeared. He was arrested, and then he was kidnapped out of jail. They know he was taken to Fort Niagara up on Lake Niagara, and from there his fate remains a mystery. There was all kinds of complications, a body washed up, his wife swore it was his body, another woman showed up who was sponsored by the Masons who swore it was her husband, never was determined whose body it was, but the case set off a frenzy of hatred of Freemasons. And it was a product of the fact that people thought that the American experiment in democracy was very delicate and that the Masons were setting up an aristocracy, which was not really true. But once people got that idea, they became obsessed with it. And it became a political movement, and the Morgan case became the seed of this political movement, to the extent that even 50 years later, people were very interested in the case. They in the 1880s, and this had happened in the 1820s, in the 1880s they erected this huge column in Batavia where Morgan was from, with his statue on the top, and said, you know, martyr to the cause of the freedom of the press. So it was a big case and never really solved.
There are, you detail the many ideas in the book of what could have happened, but they're all over the place. And we go from Turkey to Canada to having his tongue taken out. So there are a lot of different theories.
Yeah, the general understanding assumption, it has to be an assumption, is that he was killed because he never showed up again. He had a family, he had a couple of young children. He never contacted them. They went on and lived their lives. And he was the type of guy that if he had lived, I don't think he would have just disappeared. But the Freemasons came up with numerous stories of how he'd gone to Canada and he hadn't been murdered. That was, they were trying to get out of the fact that he probably had been murdered by Freemasons. So there were many, many stories. Some people supposedly confessed to killing him. Others claimed that they'd seen him, as you say, in Turkey. He'd gone down to the islands down in the South Seas. He'd gone out west and joined the Indians. Just a whole succession of stories. It's still, most Freemasons even today are familiar with the Morgan story, though now, you know, for most people it's been forgotten, but they know because it was very traumatic for Freemasons. Many, many Freemason lodges, particularly in upstate New York, closed during that time. They were kind of driven in underground by the frenzy against Masons.
How did it impact the building and the continuation of the canal?
Well, that actually had happened just after the canal officially opened. Morgan probably worked on the canal. He was actually, in addition to being a Freemason, he was actually a bricklayer as well. So he was looking for work. He was sort of falling on hard times, and he probably worked on the canal. But the fact that the canal brought in a lot of transients and a lot of change to that area, and there were people constantly coming and going, I think people weren't used to that. You know, the people were used to living in towns in New England that were pretty stable. So that instability that was brought in by the canal really contributed to a feeling of anxiety of people that then contributed to this frenzy against the Masons.
I found it fascinating in the book of thinking about this migration, if you will, of people throughout the state of New York, but basically coming from New England and making that trek. What was the lure?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with England. New England was somewhat overpopulated at that time. The farming in New England, particularly in northern, you know, Vermont and New Hampshire, was very, very difficult. It's real hard scrabble, a lot of rocky land. And the idea that there were fertile lands in western New York and then farther out in Ohio and in the Midwest as well, and that you could have access to markets from those lands once the canal opened, was the great draw. People thought that was going to be a bonanza, and it was. For many, many people went out there, started farms, grew wheat around Rochester. Rochester became the biggest flour milling city in the world, and people made a lot of money.
Jack Kelly is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book, Heaven's Ditch, God, Gold, and Murder on the Erie Canal. Right under the title on the book cover is a picture of Charles Finney, evangelist, established 1825. Tell us about Charles Finney.
Charles Finney was an interesting character to me because he was a very religious man. He was the Billy Graham of the 19th century, but he's also someone I think is easy to relate to because he started out as a skeptic. He was a lawyer, and he had no religion, and he got attracted. He was courting a woman that was religious, and there was a lot of religious. Of the religious enthusiasm that I talked about in the area. So he got interested, and he had one of these soul-shaking experiences that convinced him that he should devote his life to preaching the gospel. And he was a phenomenal preacher. And he really transformed the old style of New England Puritan Calvinist Christianity into a very new, hopeful, a positive religion that has had a great impact on American character and American culture down through all. And he invented also many of the techniques of religious revivals that became very famous as different preachers down the ages.
That actually was my next question to you. Give us a sense of these revivals and why they were so popular at this time.
The origin of the really the emotional Christian revival was on the frontier. It was, people that are isolated on the frontier. there weren't many churches out there, and there was itinerant preachers would go out and hold camp meetings. And they people just didn't have the time, and they didn't have the inclination to do a lot of meditating and mulling over of religious ideas. They wanted an emotional experience, and the preachers gave it to them. And it was a lot of hell and brimstone, shouting, jokes, and competition among the different preachers for adherence. That type of enthusiasm, and you couldn't sell the Calvinist Puritan idea of everyone is depraved and you're lucky if you have the only chance of getting to heaven is to hope to get to heaven because there's nothing you can do to get to heaven. People weren't buying that, and they wanted something that was more hopeful. They wanted something that was upbeat, and that was the new thing that Finney refined and then brought into the churches in the more settled areas, and it really caught on, and it has a huge influence on America.
What lesson do you think we can learn from the story of the Erie Canal, especially when it comes to our infrastructure?
Well, you know, Joey, infrastructure investment, I mentioned in the book, you know, there's no poetry in concrete, and there's no poetry in infrastructure investment. And it's a clunky term, unfortunately, but public works, it describes what is the basis of our economy. It's the basis of our standard of living. You know, I was thinking on the way up here, it was like even gas stations, that's part of our infrastructure. And you don't think of it as infrastructure until you buy an electric car. Then you realize, right, oh, the infrastructure is set up for gasoline cars. The Erie Canal proved that you can invest huge amounts of money, and for them it was New York State took a great risk in building the canal, and it will pay for itself. And that has been the great lesson that was made real by the canal. For some reason in our time, that lesson has been lost, and people seem to look at infrastructure investment as just a cost. It's not a cost. It's an investment that pays off down the road. The Erie Canal, in later years, collected more in tolls in 1 year than the entire cost of building the original canal. So why that we've lost that kind of foresight and gumption to build infrastructure, but we certainly have, and it's a serious problem today.
Meanwhile, the canal is in pretty good shape right now.
Yeah, it's a very well maintained part of our infrastructure.
And is it because the towns can rely on the waterfront and bringing people to that?
Yes,
to that area?
That's absolutely true. As far as the canal is mainly a tourist attraction now.
Yeah.
And a lot of towns have, in the last 10, 15 years, really woken up to the fact that it's a great amenity that they can develop, have restaurants and bars and kayaking and bike paths. And there's a bike path is now along almost the entire length of the canal. So it's being developed for that reason. And there's pleasure boats and tour boats come along the canal. And that's what it's become now. And since it's already there, it's not an extravagant expense to keep it up, and I think it's still paying for itself in a certain way.
What do you hope the takeaway for many readers is from the book?
Well, I think that one of the fundamental things that I learned from the book is the power of ideas, and both in the canal, the fact that one man could come up with this idea for building a canal across the entire state, that idea could become a reality, and the reality could have such an influence on the country. And the ideas that were put forth by the various religious and spiritual people that were active along the canal of a different form of religion, of a new religion, those ideas really have an effect on history. And a lot of times we just think it's the wars and the politics, but I think the fact that ideas matter is one of the things that really impressed me in doing the research for the book.
Jack Kelly's new book is Heaven's Ditch, God, Gold, and Murder on the Erie Canal. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Jack Kelly, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.